Well, where we were last time, which we're going to elaborate a little bit on more, is that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi describes that there is a genetic process that is taking place that begins with Adam HaRishon, that begins with Adam. And Adam possesses a kind of superhuman quality about him. His physical and spiritual makeup is superior. He is homo superiosus, or whatever you want to call it. And so it gets this kind of metagene, this kind of superhuman gene gets passed down from Adam to Sheth, from Adam to Seth, and then from Seth to one of his children, and then from one of those to another one out of many, many children. So in every generation, there is a person who possesses this superhuman gene, and this continues for the first 20 generations of humankind, from Adam to Noah, and then from Noah to Abraham. Now, what we saw last time from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is that the way that this gene manifests itself is with human beings that possess physical characteristics which are exceptional, at least during the first 20 generations. They live longer, and they are known as the Bnei HaElokim because they have certain qualities about them which make them superior to all other human beings that are living at the time. But for some reason, even though this gene continues to get passed down for subsequent generations, the physical manifestations of this gene start to disappear, and they only, therefore, are manifest on a spiritual plane after the first 20 generations. Actually, only after the first, I should say really after the first 10 generations, until Noah. From Noah onwards, then you really have people who are normal lifespans, like it says in the Torah, V'hayu yamav me'avi esrim shana, that man will have a more normal lifespan after Noah. And then by the time we get to Avram Avinu, we find that human beings are all physically the same. And the only thing that makes Avram Avinu unique, because he has inherited this gene, is that he has a certain spiritual quality that is unique, that he's able to pass down to his son, but only to one of his sons, just like we've seen before. He'll pass that on to Yitzchak, to the exclusion of Yishmael. Yitzchak will pass on this metagene to Yaakov, to the exclusion of Esav. And then we're going to see what's going to happen with Yaakov passing it on to his children. We also have to talk about Avraham Avinu's lineage, because his father, Avraham's father, seemingly does not possess this metagene, because Avraham's father is Terach, and not only is there nothing exceptional about Terach, but according to our Midrashic tradition, Terach was a pretty bad guy. Okay? So that's what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to address. And we're on page 108. We're at 1:95.4 is where we're up to, where it was possible for divinity to skip a generation. Who hasn't read for us in a while? Who hasn't read? We need a reader. Go ahead, Elisa. Just do it loud so the camera will pick it up.
In English, no?
Yes, please.
Okay. It was possible for divinity to skip a generation in this link of elite descendants, such as the case of Terach, Avraham's father, but it resumed again with Avraham, who was the disciple of his grandfather, Iver, and who knew Noah. Divinity could therefore pass from grandparents to grandchildren.
Okay, so just like in genetics, sometimes you'll have a grandchild who will have some of the features of a grandparent, even though they won't look like the parent. Yes.
So was it not possibly at some other
time? We don't find that. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says this is a patrilineal gene. It seems that way. And I think someone raised that last time as well. It's a little bit depressing, no? That it's only going through the fathers. But that's the way he describes it. It seems to be a male gene that's passed from father to son. But it could also skip a generation. The genetic quality could remain dormant within Terach and remanifest itself in Abraham from Abraham's grandfather. Okay? And so now, all along this discussion, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi seems to be conveying to us that this is a genetic process. It's a natural selection process that has nothing to do with human initiative, that has nothing to do with what people choose to do with their lives. Are you aware of this? I mean, this should be disturbing, because the way that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has described this process so far has got nothing to do with Avraham Avinu's righteousness as to why he possesses this very special gene, this chosenness. He just inherited something in his genetics, like he was born with it through no merit of his own. And so this should be something that should be troublesome to us when we look at the fact that it seems like God chooses Avraham by virtue of his righteousness and not by virtue of his genetics. So let's see if Rabbi Yehuda Halevi addresses this. It's going to remain ambiguous, but let's just finish the section. Continue reading number 5.
Avraham then was the elite descendant and disciple of Ava, which is why he was called the Ivri, the Hebrew. Ever in turn was the elite descendant of Shem, who was the elite descendant of Noah. Shem had inherited the temperate climates of the earth, of which the choicest and most temperate was the land of Canaan, known as the soil of prophecy. Regarding Noah's two other sons, Yefes went to the north and Ham went to the south.
All right, so first you see a couple of interesting things in this paragraph. Number one, the reason why Avraham is known as the Ivri, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, is because he is a descendant and disciple of Aver. Now, this is not the normal understanding of what Ivri means. Mm-hmm. The word Hebrew, or Ivri, usually we're used to learning it, as other Mephorshim say, that it's because Avraham came me'Aver HaNahar. He came from the other side of the river. He came from the east, from the other side of the river, into the land of Canaan. So he was known as the Hebrew, sort of like a foreigner. But Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says that no, because we have to emphasize the genetics of Avraham for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, it turns out that the word Aver means a genetic definition of Avraham, what his patrilineage is. And because he comes from Aver, who was a select genetic specimen, that's why Avraham is known as a Ivri, especially because his father was not exceptional genetically, did not have this spiritual gene that would manifest itself in his father. He's known as an Ivri to go back to an ancestor who did have that genetic quality that was manifest. And that's why he's known as the Ivri. Another interesting thing he says, that Aver was a descendant of Shem, right, who was the son of Noah. So all of these people have this superlative gene. But he also points out that Shem inherited the temperate climates of the earth. Now, what does this have to do with our discussion of the genetic quality of this line of family that from generation to generation? So fine, Shem inherited the most temperate climates of the earth. Yefes went to the north, means he went to Canada, and he went to places that were really cold. And Ham, as his name connotes, Ham went to the hotter places in the world. So who cares about that? What does that have to do with anything? So remember, we talked a little bit, I think either last time or a couple weeks ago, we talked about that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi seems to be implying that there's not only a nature, but there's also a nurture that helps this gene along. That a person's environment will also help to activate the superior gene. And temperate climates do have an effect upon a person's spiritual makeup. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us Eretz Yisrael as the choicest of lands. One of the reasons why is because Eretz Yisrael has a temperate climate which is best suited to produce spiritually superior people. Now, you can argue with that, and you could suggest that no, austere climates can produce more spiritual people, because the more detached you are from your environment, the more likely you are to focus on spiritual things. But that's not the way Rabbi Yehuda Halevi views it. He views that one of the advantages of Eretz Yisrael is its temperateness. It's the fact that the climate never gets too cold and never gets too hot. As a matter of fact, There were wars between, I don't even remember which Sephardic rabbi it was, maybe it was the Rambam in one of his letters, but there were classically wars between Sephardic and Ashkenazic rabbis in the medieval period. And in one letter, one of the Ashkenazic rabbis writes that the Sephardic rabbi had erred because of his hot-blooded nature. And the Sephardic rabbi wrote back is that the Ashkenazi rabbi had a frozen brain because of the climate he was in. In other words, the arguments would fly back and forth that when you live in a colder climate, you become more stoic and less emotional, less passionate, because you get frozen sort of in the climate. And when you're more in a hotter climate, you're more hot-blooded and more excitable and so forth. So whether that stereotype is accurate or not, I don't know, but certainly that's the attitude that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has, that to produce a temperate individual, you need a temperate climate. So this is fostering this unique gene, this metagene that's taking place in the production of the eventual Jewish people. So let us continue, please. Number six.
Abraham's elite descendant was Yitzchak, and Abraham's distanced his other progeny from the land of Canaan so that it would be reserved exclusively for Yitzchak.
Which is, of course, we know the story about how Abraham sends away Hagar and Yishmael, right? Because he wants Yitzchak to be able to have, and this, of course, was Sarah's influence, because she recognized this, and she wanted Yitzchak to have the exclusive use of Eretz Yisrael. Continue, please.
Yitzchak's elite descendant was Yaakov. Yaakov's brother Esav failed to gain a foothold on the land, for Yaakov had gained exclusive rights to it. All of Yaakov's children were his elite descendants, all being worthy of divinity. Therefore, they all inherited the land reserved for divinity, in other words, Canaan.
Okay. Continue, please.
Thus began a new era, when divinity rested on a community where previously it had rested only on individuals. God preserved them, caused them to multiply and raised them in Egypt, just as one would cultivate a tree which has exceptional roots, waiting for it to produce fruit of the same quality as the original tree from which it developed.
Okay, so let's hold it here for just a moment. So thus began a new era. What is unclear, once again from here, is how this new era began. Whereas before, there was only one child from a family that would inherit this gene, with Yaakov, every single son inherited the gene. And we noted before, it doesn't say Dina, it just says the 12 sons. So it seems to be, for Rabbi Yehuda Levi's perspective, that it's a patrilineal gene that gets passed down through the father. At some point, the gene switches from father to mother, because we know that in Halakha we go according to matrilineal descent. In our tradition, that change took place at the time of Matan Torah. But at least at this stage of the game, the genetics is being transferred through the father. And there would be another discussion to try and understand why that switch took place at the time of Matan Torah, that the gene is now transfers from stops being a patrilineal gene and starts to become a matrilineal gene. But in any event, Rabbi Yehuda Levi doesn't explain how this era began. It doesn't seem to be a natural process anymore, but it seems that there's some divine intervention of HaKadosh Baruch Hu making a decision that at this point there's been a sufficient passage of generations such that from now on, all of Yaakov's descendants will now possess this superior gene, and every single descendant from those 12 sons will for all perpetuity possess that superior gene. Now remember, we have two issues that we need to discuss. One is, or sort of like things that are still up in the air. One is that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had explained that originally this gene manifested itself on the physical plane so that people would be superhuman in their physique, in their physical qualities, and in their length of days. They would live much longer lives. That's why they were called the Bnei HaElokim. And the second thing is we have to see if we can understand if, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, there's any human initiative that contributes to a person being the possessor of this metagene. Because it sounds like from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi that Avram did nothing of his own merit to deserve to be chosen. He was chosen by virtue of the fact that he happened to get lucky and inherit this gene. but there was nothing of his own initiative, nothing of his own righteousness that warranted him to become the chosen people. So there are a number of Meforshim who struggle with this. I don't have a simple explanation because Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is unclear on this point. I noticed one of the commentaries, there's a rabbi named Rav Shlomo Toledano, who wrote a sefer on the Kuzari called Sipur Umachshava. It's a relatively recent sefer. And he struggles with this question, and he tries to suggest that the metagene that started with Adam began to become compromised over the course of multiple generations. After the first 10 generations, it mutated because of, I guess, the admixture of other genetic qualities from the mother's side or just passing down from generation to generation, such that it could no longer manifest itself on the physical plane. By the 20th generation, which is Avraham Avinu, not only was it no longer manifest on the physical plane, but it was in danger of being lost entirely, to the point where, unless the individual initiated his own efforts to preserve the gene, it would be permanently lost. And that's why Terach didn't have it, because Terach did not exert his own initiative in order to preserve the gene and activate the gene which lay dormant within himself. Avraham is a combination of superior genetics, superior environment, being in the land of Canaan, plus the third factor, which is his own human initiative, his own efforts at righteousness. And those three combined, even though Rabbi Yehuda Halevi doesn't say this explicitly, we have to sort of read this into the Kuzari if we're going to accept this, is that his own efforts caused him to become this superior human being, allowing him to pass the gene on to the next generation in Yitzchak, and from Yitzchak was able to do the same thing and pass it along to Yaakov. And Yaakov must have done something to enable this gene not only to be activated in one of his descendants, but in all 12 of his sons. But again, we're not really sure exactly how the mechanism works and how it's passed, but it would seem that it's a combination of both natural selection, natural genetic selection, and environment, and human initiative. But again, it's very hard to read this into Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Now, there is something to be said, and the Maharal discusses this extensively, there is something to be said about the chosenness of the Jewish people not being dependent upon our own virtue. As a matter of fact, since Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is living in the medieval period after the advent of Christianity, we have to be mindful of a theological doctrine that he may be wishing to deflect, that is held by the church, and that is the doctrine of supersessionism. That the Jews have been superseded by Christians as the new chosen people. And why is that? Because when the Jews rejected the Son of God and they turned away from their Lord, right? So God took away their chosenness and gave it to the people who would embrace their Lord, the Son of God. You know, if we can even to use their terminology. And the Maharal, who's very much a polemicist against Christian doctrine, has an essay in his Sefer Netzach Yisrael, which talks about the eternal chosenness of the Jewish people. And he writes that it is precisely because the chosenness of Klal Yisrael is not predicated on our righteousness, but is rather predicated on God's decision to choose us, and solely on that, it is impossible for the Jewish people to be superseded by anyone else, because our chosenness is not predicated on our behavior. It's predicated on the fact that God decided to choose us, and it's a mystery. It's one of those mysteries of God that we don't fully understand. And I believe that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi may be addressing the very same thing. It's impossible for the Jewish people to be superseded because the very genetic makeup of the Jewish people does not allow us to be replaced by any other nation that did not go through this genetic process. So that even if the Jewish people's behavior deteriorates, which it has over the generations, we nevertheless have an irrevocable, inexorable connection to the chosenness gene, which can never be superseded by any other nation. Yes?
First of all, we have the concept that Abraham had to go through 10 misiones. And the implication is after he went through all like the application, then God says, now I know that you will instruct your children, you will follow. Like, it seems like Abraham had to earn his position by going through the misiones.
Well, that's a very good question. We see that God tests Abraham, but you could suggest that the testing itself is not the initiation process, but rather an education process. Meaning, you know, let's say I have a son I want to take into the family business, right? I have a factory, and I want my children to take over the factory for me. So it's a foregone conclusion that my kids are going to take over the factory because they're my kids. But I still have to teach them how to run a factory. So I'll send them to university, and I'll hire them to work as summer interns, and I'll start them in the mailroom, and they'll work their way up the chain. And I'll put them through various tests to make sure that they're up to the job. But that's already despite the fact that I've already chosen them to take over.
Well, if they should, completely competent, would you still put them in a position like
that? Absolutely. You have to. That's what the word nisayon means, to demonstrate their innate capabilities. That's what the Ramban says on the word nisayon. So it's not that God was this was not an initiation necessarily for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. This was an education. That, okay, Abram, I've chosen you because of your genetic makeup. Now let's make sure that you know that through your chosenness, you're going to have to take a Torah and pass it on to your descendants, and that they know the ways of God. Because your chosenness requires you to pass on a legacy to your family. This legacy requires an education.
The other question I have is, Sarah was a prophetess, and we said that this gene allowed a person to be a prophet. So if he said that the women don't have the superior gene, how is it that Sarah was able to be a prophetess?
That's a good question. I don't have an answer. Unless we say that Sarah, because she, by virtue of the fact that she was Abraham's cousin, may have inherited it from her parents as well. That's the only answer that I can come up with at the moment. It's a very legitimate question. We're going to have other issues with Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's prophecy gene also. We'll have to get to that. Okay, so thus began a new era. And then Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says that the way that the Jewish people are compared, because Hashem raises them in Egypt, just as one would cultivate a tree which has exceptional roots. So here again, he's using the nurture and nature kind of analogy. The Jewish people are a species of tree, which is exceptional. But just because you're an exceptional species doesn't mean that you're going to necessarily grow into an exceptional tree. Just because your species is exceptional, you have to be cultivated properly. And you have to, right, and that's the initiation process. Waiting for it to produce fruit of the same quality as the original tree from which it developed. And please continue.
The fruit of the original tree was Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Yosef, and his brothers. The new fruit included Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. It also included the likes of Kesalo and Ahaliah, and the tribal heads and the 70 elders who were worthy of unending prophecy. And Yoshua ben Nun, Caleb ben Yehuna, Miriam's son Hor, and many more. These people were worthy of being illuminated by the divine light and of receiving God's individual promise.
So for the first time, we're seeing within Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi something really also that may be a little bit disturbing to some of us, and that is that even within this family of the Jewish people, not everyone gets to become the fruit. We are all part of an exceptional tree, and of course the objective of the tree is to produce fruits. But I may be just the leaf or a branch, I may not be the actual fruit. In order to become the fruit, I have to achieve greatness by becoming a prophet and becoming a religious leader. And so therefore, even though in the first generation of Jews that leave Mitzrayim, you have 600,000 Jews, not all of them have this manifestation of their exceptional gene come to the fore where they are able to demonstrate that they are part of this chosen genetically elite people. There are only choice individuals within that generation who actually manifest that gene. For everyone else, that gene remains dormant and it doesn't manifest itself. And here also, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi doesn't specify whether the active nature or the dormant nature of this gene is due to human initiative or whether it's simply due to genetics. And he leaves it up to us to try and understand how it works. But one thing is clear, only a few people of that generation were able to manifest themselves as fruit versus being part of the rest of the tree. As we're going to see, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi will continuously return back to this analogy of the tree, not only to describe exceptional individuals within the Jewish people in every generation, but also to describe the tree of humanity, so to speak, that all of creation can be metaphorically compared to a tree. All of humanity is like a tree, in that there are exceptional human beings, which comprise the Jewish people, and we represent the fruits of the tree of humanity. And even within the Jewish people, there are those who represent the fruit and those who represent the rest of the tree, which is there in order to help the fruit come to fruition. So it's clearly a process of where there are those who have more and those who have less. There are those who are the elites and those who are just the regular guys. And that's just the way that he understands all of nature. And he says that's the process which God embedded within the world, and that's just the way the world works. It's not that these other components of the world do not serve a purpose. They do serve a purpose. But just like a tree, not every component of the tree can be fruit. You need to have leaves and roots and bark and branches and so forth in order for fruit to grow. So too, in order for superhuman beings to be able to be the most elite of humanity to emerge in the world, you need the majority of humanity to be ordinary, to be able to foster the existence of these exceptional human beings. So, it's very much contrary to what we're used to hearing in society today, where everyone's great. Where everyone is exceptional. There was that line from the movie in The Incredibles. I don't know if you remember that movie from a few years back, which I think is godless. I think that movie has a lot of profundity to it. It's a Disney film that was made by Pixar maybe about 10 years ago. And in this movie, it's all about the villain wants to make everyone a superhero. Because he says, when everyone becomes special, no one will be special. Yes?
But according to what you just said, everyone is special because without everybody else, the fruit would not be able to exist. So everybody who does something to make the fruit, then they're, like when you do a robbery, the accomplice to the robber is as guilty as the robber himself. Everybody's part of the same thing.
Yes, we're all special, but some are more special than others. just like an animal farm, right?
I think that's like they said, behind every great man, there's a great woman. So you see, there's everybody needs everybody else. It's not like one person's better than another.
Okay, and that seems to be a pervasive message within society today, that we have to remember that we all have redemption and we have value. And that I believe in, and there's a place for that. I just spoke about it this past Shabbos, that there's redemptive value in every human being, and we have to remember that. That there's specialness in every single Jew. But at the same time, it depends on the context of the conversation. At the end of the day, we do have to resign ourselves to the fact that not everyone is equal. We can't say that all people are equal, but some are more equal than others, like George Orwell said, right? Because that eventually results in the corruption of mankind. Yes? Yes?
It also says, Rav Sashik Ba'al Yom Yisir Masher Ba'al Yisir Kul Ben Buzi. The implication is even a common and stated flaw more than it has gone, and that attests to the greatness of the experience and the greatness of the level of the people.
It does attest to the magnitude of the experience. It doesn't really attest to the greatness of the people. As many of the Mephorshim point out, the Chazal don't really mean to say that a handmaiden at the ocean was greater than Yecheskel Ben Buzi. Otherwise, we should have had the book of handmaiden, not the book of Ezekiel, right? the reality is that it was such an overwhelming experience, that it was a greater prophetic revelation at the time of the splitting of the Red Sea than Yechezkel was ever capable of because he lived in the diaspora. But as far as his inherent greatness, because he was a righteous man and spent his whole life dedicating himself, decades and decades of his life dedicated to righteousness, there's no way that a handmaiden who had just come out of Egypt, who had previously, 24 hours before then, was worshipping idols, that we could ever say that she was of a superior level to Yechezkel ben Buzi. That just doesn't make sense.
If she's capable of this great revelation, that says something about the handmaiden. Like, you might even have the Rambam, you just can't get this kind of great revelation if you're with a lady, you need a special gene to be able to accomplish that.
You need to be part of a special gene, that's true, right? But at the same time, there's something called Isarusa Mila'ela and Isarusa Mila'sata. There's external stimulation or external affectation, and then there's internal affectation, that what am I able to do of my own initiative? And again, Rabbi Yehuda Levi doesn't really address this. As I said, this is the part that's missing from this text. How much of this greatness emerges as a result of these people's own efforts, and how much is it as a result of their genetics or their environment and so forth? Okay, let us continue. Paragraph 8.
I just wanted to make a comment first.
Yes, go right ahead.
So going back to the analogy of the tree in general, you could argue that even the rotten fruit on a tree, so the fruit actually rotting and falling off the tree, serves a purpose in the growth and the cultivation of the tree itself.
Absolutely.
Because it eventually will fall into the ground and become fertilizer.
And become fertilizer. Good. So, absolutely. That's a very good analogy.
Anyway, so if there were sinners among them, they were rejected by God, but even they were elite descendants, as is evidenced by their ancestry, their innate qualities, and their ability to sire elite descendants. This is why a wicked person will sometimes be spared, so that the elite quality that he possesses will be distilled and will manifest itself in his child or grandchild.
Now, this is a very bold statement Rabbi Yehuda Levi is making, is that sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be forbearing with an individual because his destiny is to give birth to a child or grandchild that is destined for greatness. Mm-hmm. And we find this Korach actually had made this mistake because he foresaw in his own lineage that he himself was destined for greatness, but what he failed to realize is that this prophecy was for his descendants, for his grandchildren, and not for himself. And that's why Lamasech Libnei Korach, the descendants of Korach, were descended for greatness, but not Korach himself. Ashes Potiphar, we're told, made the same mistake. She foresaw that she was destined for greatness to be a sire, a child through Yosef, when in reality it was her daughter. The Zohar, we quote in footnote 125, says the Almighty is forbearing with the wicked for the sake of the goodly seed which may spring from them for the benefit of the world, as there issued from Terach that goodly scion Avraham, who was a blessing for the world. Let us continue. This is what
occurred with Terach and others, as we mentioned above, who did not merit the divinity. Nevertheless, because of their elite ancestry, they sired elite descendants. But this quality existed only in this pedigree and did not exist in the pedigree of Cham and Yefes.
So no matter how hard you tried, if you were from the children of Cham and Yefes, and not from the descendants of Shem, no matter how righteous you were, no matter how temperate the climate that you chose to live in, no matter how much effort you exerted in your life to achieve this spiritual greatness, it was impossible. You could not achieve it because you simply did not possess the genetic faculties to be able to achieve this kind of prophetic level. And again, so for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, it's hardwired within the Jewish people. One last paragraph, and then we'll hold it.
This phenomenon is common in genetics as well. Often we find a son who does not resemble his father at all, but closely resembles his grandfather. Undoubtedly, the genetics and resemblance were dormant within the father, even though they were not outwardly apparent. So too, Aver's genetics lay dormant in his children until they surfaced with Avram.
Once again, explaining why Avram is known as Avraham HaIvri, yeah, to show that he traced his excellence back to his grandfather, great-grandfather, Aver. Okay, this is a good place. Yes?
Question?
Sure.
You're talking about achieving greatness as if there's a test that you're giving to your students and you want to achieve greatness, but you want to give 100%. But there is no objective test because Hashem gives everybody a different starting point, may look like achieving greatness to you, or what may look like not achieving greatness may be to that person achieving greatness. So, in a way, I feel like it's pointless to talk about achieving greatness because only Hashem knows how far a person goes given his capabilities.
Correct. That's exactly what we're saying. The Jewish people, because of their ancestry, had greater potential than any other human being in the world at the time. And as a result, God put them in certain situations in order to bring out that human potential that no other human being possessed. God put them in Egypt. He put them through a cauldron of human bondage, of human experience, so that they would emerge as the chosen people.
But what I'm saying is it not possible that somebody who starts handicapped and achieves much less than a person who starts with everything going for him and achieves what we think is more, the first person might be greater in God's eyes? Like, there's no objective way of us keeping score of who's achieving the most, who's not achieving the most.
You're right, as far as gauging a person's vis-a-vis their capabilities. But there are objective gauges of greatness. I will never play for the NBA, so if your gauge of greatness is how many slam dunks can I make, then I will never achieve that absolute greatness. For spiritual greatness, the absolute gauge is who can achieve prophecy and who cannot. And therefore, for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the Jewish people are the only nation of which some of its constituents can achieve prophecy. No other nation has that genetic capacity for that kind of greatness. What you're talking about is something when a person is competing against themselves. And you're right, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes that into account as well. There is a reckoning that God makes with every single human being based upon that person's capacity, right? So therefore, there are certain people who only have capacity for this much, and they could exert themselves to the nth degree and reach that capacity, and therefore, on a level as far as their personal greatness or righteousness, however you want to call it, God will reward them for their initiative more than he would reward a Jew who's achieved this much but only is trying with one hand tied behind his back. That's true. I agree with that. But we're not talking about reward. We're talking about achieving a gaugeable kind of spiritual greatness that is something that is on an absolute manifest level in this world. That's what we're talking about here. Okay, so we're going to have to come back to this because we haven't yet explained what this has to do with the golden calf. And we will. That'll be our next discussion after Yontif, God willing.